and at all. What happened? My own collected thought encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits. Here, in print, it is impossible to reproduce the communal dialogue this story usually generates, impossible to do more than hint at the power of such a dialogue to illumine, affirm, and question our lives. Here, the complex and probing discourse that would go on in a circle of trust gets reduced to a single voice, mine. So your imagination will be required to redeem what follows. Imagine that you are sitting in a circle with 20 people, each of whom has a copy of The Woodcarver in hand. The facilitator asks questions to guide a dialogue. People respond, some inwardly, some aloud, often allowing brief silences to fall between speakers. Laughter as well as solemnity is laced through the conversation. And together we weave a fabric of meanings about both the story and our own lives. As I describe this communal process, imagine that you are part of it, and let the woodcarver's story evoke your own. The facilitator begins by asking if someone, whoever wishes, will read the first stanza aloud, someone else the second, and so on, until the whole story has been told. Hearing the story read aloud in several voices, with their varied inflections and emphases, hints at the rich potential of the communal process. Then the facilitator asks an overview question that allows people to offer first takes on the text as a whole. What is this story about for you? How does it intersect your life at this moment? Is there a word, a phrase, or an image here that speaks directly to your condition? After some silence, someone says, I am a teacher. I don't work with wood, but I see parallels here to my work with children. I really want to help all of my students find the bell stand within themselves. Another says, the story makes me think of my work. I am constantly under pressure to produce results just like the woodcarver, and it is really getting to me. Yet another says, I need some way of stepping back from everyday demands to reflect more deeply on what I am doing, the way the woodcarver did. But I just can't seem to do it. I envy this guy's chance to be contemplative. As people speak about ways in which the story intersects their lives, at least two things happen. People who speak may hear themselves naming truths they have not named before, and even if they have, naming them in front of others helps the speaker take them more seriously. People who listen, even if they do not speak, may hear someone give voice to a truth that is their truth as well, one that they would never have thought to name for themselves. Whether we speak or listen or do both, exploring inner life issues in community via a third thing can yield important insights. My own speaking and listening in many circles of trust have given me some insights into how the woodcarver's tale illumines my life. As a facilitator participant, I might say something like this. Like me, King is under pressure to be concerned only about externals, the prince and his command, the product he is supposed to deliver, the tools and materials available to him, the way others evaluate his work. But he turns away from these externals toward inner truth, not to escape the world, but to return to it in a way that will allow him to co-create something of worth and beauty. He makes this inward turn in a very stressful situation. The command to make the bell stand came from a prince who rules over a workplace that has no personnel handbook and no grievance procedure. Suppose King had messed up. The prince might have had him killed. Despite the fear he must have felt, King takes the prince's command and transforms it into a choice. Of course, not all commands can or should be chosen. Some should be resisted unto death. But sometimes I receive commands from another person or from my life situation that evoke something from me that I did not know I had. If I can embrace that kind of command and transform it into a choice, good things may happen. When I became a parent, for example, I did not anticipate the extent to which my life would be under command for many years to come, what young parent does. But when I can embrace such a command as a choice, my life becomes larger, as it has from helping to raise 3 children. At this point, some people in the circle are nodding in agreement, but others see things quite differently. Well, I wish I had a boss who would give me 7 days off to contemplate my assignment. Or, I wish I had a job like King's, with only one task at a time and with no family responsibilities. After all, this guy didn't have to make the meals, wash the dishes, mow the lawn, and get the car repaired. These people are saying that if their lives were as fancy-free as the woodcarver's, they too could live creatively and with integrity. But in the real world, the woodcarver's path is obviously an impossible dream. When conflicting viewpoints arise in a circle of trust, we arrive at a critical moment. Now we can easily slip back into business as usual, arguing about whether the real world is as confining as some people suggest, trying to talk each other into or out of some opinion. Now we may forget why we are here, not to persuade anyone of anything or to reach consensus on how things really are, but to help each person listen to his or her inner teacher. In such a moment, the facilitator can remind people of the Rorschach inkblot analogy. Our responses to the woodcarver say more about us than about the text, so we must pay close attention to what we ourselves are saying. We are not here to debate the story's objective meaning as if it had one, or what the story means for someone else's life as if we knew. We are here to protect and border and salute each other's solitude, as each of us listens for whatever meanings the story and our dialogue about it may evoke from our own inner teacher. At the same time, the facilitator needs to remind people that a text has a voice of its own, one that we must listen to as attentively as we listen to other people's voices. In this case, the facilitator might point out that nowhere does this story say that the prince gave King 7 days off in order to fast and forget. It simply says that King went through a process that took 7 days. Nor does the story tell us that King abandoned hearth and home to go off on retreat by himself. He might well have done his fasting and forgetting in the midst of his ongoing family, workplace, and civic responsibilities. Gently but firmly, the facilitator's message must be this. Whether you find yourself drawn to or repelled by the story or someone else's interpretation of it, simply take note of your response and reflect on it. Ask yourself what personal experiences lie behind it. Ask yourself what inner issues you may be projecting. Try to understand your own responses, and you may discover that your inner teacher has something important to say. After a while, the facilitator no longer needs to remind people about all this. As participants begin to understand that whatever they say about a third thing they are saying about themselves, the reminders come from within. Naming our own truth. Having begun by inviting people to explore the story openly for 10 or 15 minutes, the facilitator needs to bring the dialogue into sharper focus, balancing openness with intentionality. As facilitator, I might say something like this. Stories such as The Woodcarver always reward close reading. So let's start working our way through the tale step by step. First, let's look at the way Zhuangzi sets the stage for this drama in the first few lines. King, the master carver, made a bell stand of precious wood. When it was finished, all who saw it were astounded. They said it must be the work of spirits. The Prince of Lu said to the Master Carver, "What is your secret?" King replied, "I am only a workman. I have no secret." Here King is surrounded by spectators who are dazed by the beauty of the bell stand. The people say it must be the work of spirits. The Prince asks, "What is your secret?" And King replies, "I am only a workman. I have no secret." How do you understand what is going on here? What do you think the parties to this exchange are trying to say to each other? One person says that the prince and the people were simply in awe of the woodcarver's capacity to create beauty. Someone else suggests that they lusted after King's secret so they could mass-produce and market his work as a Walmart special. Another believes that the prince was threatened by the woodcarver's powers and was trying to regain the upper hand by uncovering his tricks. Yet another claims that both the prince and the people were trying to evade the challenge of using their own human gifts by treating the woodcarver as if he were superhuman. As people speak, we learn at least two things. First, people interpret these opening lines differently because they have different inner issues. Second, just as we are projecting our needs onto the story, so the people in the story are projecting their needs onto the woodcarver. Whether the source of the projections within the story is awe, commercial self-interest, lust for power, or self-abnegation, this much seems clear. As the action gets underway, King is surrounded by powerful projections that make him into a magician of some sort. Surely these projections appealed to King's ego. At least that is my response to this Rorschach test. Who would not want to be credited with superhuman abilities? We gladly embrace projections of this sort all the time. It is called professional posturing. Of course I have a secret, but I spent a lot of time and money to get trained as a doctor, or an accountant, or a mechanic, and I'm not about to give my secret away. I may tell you a little about the tricks of my trade, but I will use words so obscure that you will not understand what I am saying. Yet King resists the projections people lay on him. Why? Because he knows that as soon as we succumb to someone else's definition of who we are, we lose our sense of true self and of our right relation to the world. It makes no difference whether those projections make us the hero or the goat. When we allow others to name us, we lose touch with our own truth and undermine our capacity to co-create in life-giving ways with the other. You do not need to be a master of anything to be caught in a web of projections. You need only live and work with other people. Teachers catch projections when students say, in effect, "You're the expert. Just give us the answers so we don't have to think for ourselves," tempting them to dispense information instead of helping students learn. Writers catch projections when readers say, in effect, "You wrote a book on this subject, so you must be an expert on it," tempting them to lose the edge of not knowing that animates the best thinking and writing. Parents catch projections from children, bosses from employees, politicians from citizens. The list is endless, and the projections are endlessly distorting. So the woodcarver resists people's efforts to name him from the outside in. With simplicity and clarity, he claims the right to name himself from the inside out. "I am only a workman. I have no secret." When we fail to take this first critical step of fending off projections and reserving the right to name our own truth, we become lost in eternal smoke and mirrors and cannot even find the trailhead of the path into our inner lives. As we explore the opening movement of the woodcarver, questions start to grow for everyone in the circle. What projections surround me? Where do they come from? What drives them? How do they distort my sense of self? How am I dealing with them, and how might I deal with them better? How can I name and claim my own truth? Such questions and our answers to them are critical steps on the journey toward an undivided life. The work before the work. The woodcarver knows that to do good work, he must deal with external constraints without compromising his inner freedom, letting these polarities flow into each other like the surfaces of a Möbius strip. So he begins not by focusing on the job the prince commanded him to do, but on a job much nearer at hand, the inner work of reclaiming true self, a work he does without ceasing as his story unfolds. As we explore the story in a circle of trust, people realize that King, who has been asked how he created such a remarkable work of art, says nothing about the kind of chisel he used, the angle at which he held it, or the amount of pressure he applied as he carved the wood. One reason for this, of course, is that tools and techniques are second nature to someone who has spent years perfecting his craft. But there is a deeper reason for King's silence on the technical aspects of his work. As important as they are not the most challenging aspect of bringing truth and beauty into the world. The real challenge is the one King talks about, the formation of the human heart behind the skillful hand. I call this part of the story the work before the work. a phrase I try to remember when I receive a new command. Before I turn to my work in the world, I have inner work to do. When I began to think about the work you commanded, I guarded my spirit, did not expend it on trifles that were not to the point. I fasted in order to set my heart at rest. After 3 days fasting, I had forgotten gain and success. After 5 days, I had forgotten praise or criticism. After 7 days, I had forgotten my body with all its limbs. There is a lovely irony in the fact that King, who had just proclaimed, "I have no secret," proceeds to reveal what seems to be a secret of the First Order by describing the inner journey that took him from the prince's command to the tree with the bell stand in it. As the facilitator of a circle of trust, I invite people to take this description not as a formula to be followed, but as a set of images to stimulate imagination. What are your personal parallels to guarding or fasting or forgetting? What do you do or wish you could do to arrive at the inner place King comes to before he enters the forest? What is your version of the inner journey toward an undivided life? Here are some of my own responses to this part of the Rorschach test. King describes his first inward step by saying, "I guarded my spirit." This may sound like those illusory second and third phases in the relation of our inner and outer lives, an effort to hide out behind a wall and hold the world at bay. But that is not how King describes what he means by guarding. He says, "I guarded my spirit, did not expend it on trifles that were not to the point." Instead of guarding his spirit against the outside world, a world that is always with us, from which there is no escape, King guarded his spirit against his own tendency to expend it on trivia, to respond to external forces with knee-jerk reflexes instead of reflective self-determination. In particular, King guarded himself against the reflex called fear. When he says, "I fasted in order to set my heart at rest," he acknowledges that his heart was fearful when he first received the prince's command. As a person well acquainted with fear, I take consolation in the fact that King, who has done his work so well for so long that he is called a master carver, found himself afraid once again when he got his new assignment. As a young man, I yearned for the day when, rooted in the experience that comes only with age, I could do my work fearlessly. But today, in my mid-60s, I realize that I will feel fear from time to time for the rest of my life. I may never get rid of my fear. But like King, I can learn to walk into it and through it whenever it rises up. So I watch with fascination as King takes the next step on his inner journey. He heightens his awareness of life on the Mobius Strip by naming the inner forces that trigger his fear, forces against which he must guard his spirit lest they distort his relation to the outer world. In particular, he names his attraction to gain and success and his vulnerability to praise or criticism. The world uses punishments and rewards to motivate us, to redirect us, or to keep us in line. But those sanctions cannot work until we internalize them. Only when we assent to the world's logic does it have power over us. So King withdraws his assent by fasting and forgetting. Of course, forgetting about gain and success, praise and criticism, is easier said than done. But naming our fears aloud, as King does, and as we can do in a circle of trust, is a first step toward transcending them. Then King says that he forgot his body with all its limbs. People sometimes feel that these words devalue the body, but my response to this Rorschach test is the reverse. Anyone who works at a high level of physical skill, as a good woodcarver, athlete, or instrumentalist does, must trust his or her body implicitly, which is tantamount to forgetting. A shortstop or concert pianist who wonders for even a split second whether his or her hands are correctly positioned will flub that hard-hit ground ball or falter in the middle of that fast-moving Chopin riff. When we forget the body in this way, we learn the true meaning of the old saying that the body has a mind of its own. even those of us who play neither baseball nor a Steinway, must learn to trust bodily knowledge as part of our inner guidance. As we do so, we, like the woodcarver, become less responsive to external commands and more responsive to the inner teacher. We start to live in closer conformity to our own souls. As we explore the work before the work in a circle of trust, people wrestle, aloud and in silence, with many important questions about the inner journey. How do I guard my spirit? Do I even believe in guarding it, or have I been conditioned simply to give my spirit away? What fears paralyze me? Can I name them with the same liberating clarity that King names gain and success, praise and criticism, and bodily security? What practices do I have that parallel King's fasting and forgetting that could help me move into and through my fears for the sake of reclaiming true self? As the woodcarver deals with such questions, his journey emerges from the inside of the Möbius strip and takes him toward engagement with the outside world. By this time, all thought of Your Highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand. Then I went to the forest to see the trees in their own natural state. When the right tree appeared before my eyes, the bell stand also appeared in it, clearly, beyond doubt. All I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin. Long before the bell stand arrives on the scene, there are three critical outcomes of the work before the work that we can explore in a circle of trust, each of them leading to reflection on the parallels in our own lives. Consider first the sheer chutzpah of the woodcarver's words to the prince. By this time all thought of Your Highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. It is as if your boss asked how you managed to do so well with the assignment he or she gave you, and you replied, "Well, frankly, I had to forget that you and this organization even exist." Which is, of course, true. When we are attuned to the expectations of the boss or the corporate culture, rather than to the soul's imperatives, we cannot co-create anything of truth and beauty. If that man from the Department of Agriculture had not allowed the thought of his boss and the bureaucracy to fade away for a while, he would never have heard his inner teacher say, "You report to the land." Second, King says, "I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand." He does not say, as we might, "I collected my thoughts and came up with the perfect plan for a bell stand." Instead, he uses the passive form of the verb, indicating that he let go of his own intentions and died to his own ego, allowing himself to be gathered up into a larger truth that gave shape to his work. Here, I believe, is the heart of our spiritual yearning, to be connected with something larger and truer than our own egos and their designs. Third, King's inner work takes him into the forest, back to the outer world. Then I went to the forest to see the trees in their own natural state. All I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin. The inner journey, pursued faithfully and well, always takes us back to the world of action. But when we return to that world, we find ourselves in a different place than before we took the inner journey. Now King has no anxious and ambitious plans to impose on the trees in the forest. He walks into the woods in possession of his own truth, and is thus able to see the true nature of each tree. In one tree he saw the bell stand, clearly beyond doubt, not because he had superior knowledge of trees, but because he had superior knowledge of himself. Work of every sort has its equivalent to the woodcarver's tree. For the parent, it is a child. For the teacher, a student. For the manager, an employee. For the writer, words. For the mechanic, a machine. When we do not see ourselves clearly, we can see the other only through a glass darkly. But when we are clear about our own identities, as the woodcarver is about his, we can be clearer about the identity of the other as well. And from this truer knowing emerges truer co-creation. This live encounter. Having said, all I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin, King ends his story this way. If I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all. What happened? My own collected thought encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits. With the words, if I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all, King challenges the conceit at the heart of our concept of professionalism. I mean the conceit that, given sound knowledge, skillful means, and the power to impose our will, we can always get the desired results from the raw materials of the world. King knows differently. Like every good gardener, potter, teacher, and parent, he understands that the other with which we work is never mere raw material to be formed into any shape we choose. Every other we work with has its own nature, its own limits and potentials, with which we must learn to co-create if we hope to get real results. Good work is relational, and its outcomes depend on what we are able to evoke from each other. At the heart of this story is a truth that took me a long time to see, partly because it is unspoken, partly because it makes me nervous. For the bell stand to be created, the tree had to be cut down. The bell stand would not have emerged had King been unwilling to take a saw to the tree and leave sawdust on the forest floor. I find constant parallels to this fact in my own work as a teacher. Now and then I meet a student in whom I think I see a bell stand, some marvelous gift that the student has not yet seen or brought into being. Sometimes my effort to release that bell stand, though difficult for both the student and me, eventually brings both of us joy because the student is ready and willing to name and claim his or her gift. But at other times, the cutting I do leads only to pain, for one of two reasons. Sometimes the student has a bell stand inside, but fights the process of releasing it. This student is not ready to embrace his or her gift. And I am the man in the Kazantzaki story who tries to force life upon the butterfly. And sometimes the student does not have what I thought I saw. I have projected a gift that is not there, because my ego wants that student to be someone he or she is not, perhaps to prove what a good teacher I am. In this case, if I fail to withdraw my false projection in time, I may do the student real harm. Good work is risky business. When failure compels me to recognize those risks, I can easily become paralyzed by fear, reverting, for example, to the safety of teaching by rote rather than relationship. At such moments, there is one line in The Woodcarver that speaks to me as deeply as any other. All I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin. Once one has known failure, the very act of putting forth your hand and beginning again can be an act of real courage. But King's final words invite us beyond fear, back to the hopeful heart of the matter. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits. Live encounters are partnerships in which the full powers of two or more beings are at play, the woodcarver and the tree, the teacher and the student, the leader and the led. Helping more of these partnerships happen in our lives is what this story is about for me. Live encounters are unpredictable, challenging, and risky. They carry no guarantees, so they are much less popular than those inert collisions in which we treat each other as objects. But live encounters offer us something that inert collisions lack. They are full of the vitality that makes life worth living, and they enhance our odds of doing worthy work. As we end our exploration of the woodcarver in a circle of trust, we emerge with a heightened awareness of life on the Möbius strip. The inner teacher has been stimulated by reflective and respectful dialogue, yielding insights that might not have come to us had we been alone with the tale. But once we have explored the story in a circle of trust, the woodcarver himself can become a companion on our continuing journey. When a third thing comes alive for us in community, we can carry on a dialogue with it long after the circle has disbanded. Or so it has been for me with King the Woodcarver, a character from whom I have received much guidance since I first met him in community some 30 years ago. He is available to me in every moment of daily life, having been rendered so vivid in my imagination by so many circles of trust. Chapter 7. Deep speaks to deep, learning to speak and listen. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. William Stafford. A Tale of the Inner Teacher. Approaching soul truth on the slant through the use of third things helps create a circle of trust. But we make or break that circle by the way we speak, listen, and respond to each other about a poem, a topic, a feeling, or a problem. Here we are governed by that simple but countercultural rule. No fixing, no saving, no advising, no setting each other straight. I want to tell a story about how difficult and revelatory abiding by that rule can be. In a racially diverse circle of trust, there was a white middle school teacher, Janet, who sat through the first retreat in silence, looking angry and distracted. No one invaded Janet by asking her what was wrong, or evaded her by pretending she was not there. Instead, people went on with their dialogue while remaining present and open to her, waiting for her soul to appear. At the start of the second retreat, as the group explored a poem that touched on racial issues, Janet's grievances began to spill out. She was having a terrible time in her classroom, and it was all the fault of those students, and all of those students were black. But no one invaded Janet by challenging her about racism, or evaded her by pretending she was not there, this despite the fact that there were a number of teachers in the circle, black and white, who must have been deeply upset about what their colleague was saying. Instead, everyone continued to wait for Janet's soul. Sometimes Janet's grievances were received in respectful silence before someone said something else about the poem. Occasionally, someone responded to her with an honest, open question, giving her an opportunity to explore the situation. What first happened that made you feel this way? Or, what do you find most difficult about so-and-so? Though Janet almost always used such questions not to explore, but to expand on her complaints. From time to time, other teachers spoke of binds they had gotten into with their students, and a couple of black teachers told stories of their own struggles with students who happened to be white. These stories were told not in judgment of Janet, but as honest testimony to the fact that we are all in this together. And one story involved such a hilarious moment of cultural crossed wires that this heavy topic became a little lighter for a while. Janet struggled with her demons during the second and third retreats. Then, at the fourth retreat, something remarkable happened. Speaking through tears, Janet told the group that after the last retreat, she had become appalled at what she had heard herself saying. She had resolved to build a better relationship with her most difficult student and had learned things about his life that turned some of her anger to compassion. Her classroom troubles had diminished as she acted on the insight that a big part of the problem came from inside of her. There are times, of course, when we need to confront scourges such as racism head-on, but confrontation often falls short of transformation. Some people are coerced into short-lived changes of heart, while others cling more tightly to the errors of their ways. Janet's transformation was deep and abiding, because it came from within, made possible by a community that trusted her inner teacher and allowed her to hear its voice. Why do we want to help? No fixing, no saving, no advising, no setting each other straight. The rule is simple. But abiding by it is hard work for people accustomed to straightening each other out as a way of life. Once, when I introduced the rule at the start of a long-term circle, someone blurted out, "Then what in heaven's name are we going to do with each other for the next 2 years? You've just excluded the only things we know how to do." And that, as they say, is no joke, especially for those of us in the so-called helping professions, who sometimes act as if our entire reason for being is to set other people straight. I recently facilitated a session where one participant was so certain that another's mortal soul depended on her advice, rules be damned, that I had to ask her 3 times to cease and desist. So what do we do in a circle of trust? We do what the people in Janet's circle did. We speak our own truth. We listen receptively to the truth of others. We ask each other honest, open questions instead of giving counsel. And we offer each other the healing and empowering gifts of silence and laughter. This way of being together is so countercultural that it requires clear explanation, steady practice, and gentle but firm enforcement by a facilitator who can keep us from reverting to business as usual. But once we have experienced it, we want to take this way of being into other relationships, from friendship and the family to the workplace and civic life. If we are to embrace the spirit, as well as the letter of the law that governs a circle of trust, we need to understand why the habit of fixing, saving, advising, and setting each other straight has such a powerful grip on our lives. There are times, of course, when that habit is benign, when what grips us is simple compassion. You have a problem, you share it with me, and wanting to help, I offer you counsel in the hope that it will be useful. So far, so good. But the deeper your issue goes, the less likely it is that my advice will be of any real value. I may know how to fix your car or help you write a paper, but I do not know how to salvage your failing career, repair your broken marriage, or save you from despair. My answer to your deepest difficulties merely reflects what I would do if I were you, which I am not. And even if I were your psycho-spiritual clone, my solution would be of little use to you unless it arose from within your soul and you claimed it as your own. In the face of our deepest questions, the kind we are invited to explore in circles of trust, our habit of advising each other reveals its shadow side. If the shadow could speak its logic, I think it would say something like this: if you take my advice, you will surely solve your problem. If you take my advice but fail to solve your problem, you did not try hard enough. If you fail to take my advice, I did the best I could, so I am covered. No matter how things come out, I no longer need to worry about you or your vexing problem. The shadow behind the fixes we offer for issues that we cannot fix is, ironically, the desire to hold each other at bay. It is a strategy for abandoning each other while appearing to be concerned. Perhaps this explains why one of the most common laments of our time is that no one really sees me, hears me, or understands me. How can we understand another when instead of listening deeply, we rush to repair that person in order to escape further involvement? The sense of isolation and invisibility that marks so many lives, not least the lives of young people whom we constantly try to fix, is due in part to a mode of helping that allows us to dismiss each other. When you speak to me about your deepest questions, you do not want to be fixed or saved. You want to be seen and heard, to have your truth acknowledged and honored. If your problem is soul deep, your soul alone knows what you need to do about it, and my presumptuous advice will only drive your soul back into the woods. So the best service I can render when you speak to me about such a struggle is to hold you faithfully in a space where you can listen to your inner teacher. But holding you that way takes time, energy, and patience. As the minutes tick by, with no outward sign that anything is happening for you, I start feeling anxious, useless, and foolish, and I start thinking about all the other things I have to do, Instead of keeping the space between us open for you to hear your soul, I fill it up with advice, not so much to meet your needs as to assuage my anxiety and get on with my life. Then I can disengage from you, a person with a troublesome problem, while saying to myself, I tried to help. I walk away feeling virtuous. You are left feeling unseen and unheard. How do we change these deeply embedded habits of fixing, saving, advising, and setting each other straight? How do we learn to be present to each other by speaking our own truth, listening to the truth of others, asking each other honest, open questions, and offering the gifts of laughter and silence? These ways of being together are so important in a circle of trust that each of them has its own chapter in this book. This chapter is devoted to learning to speak and listen. Chapter 8, to the art of asking honest, open questions. And Chapter 9, to the clarifying and healing power of silence and laughter. Talking to ourselves. What does it mean to speak our own truth in a circle of trust? Of course, the question cannot be answered in terms of the content, which will vary vastly depending on who is speaking and when. But no matter what the content may be, speaking our truth in a circle of trust always takes the same form. We speak from our own center to the center of the circle, to the receptive heart of the communal space, where what we say will be held attentively and respectfully. This way of speaking differs markedly from everyday conversations in which we speak from our own intellect or ego directly to the intellect or ego of someone on whom we hope to have an impact. Everyday speech is instrumental rather than expressive, intended to achieve a goal rather than simply to tell one's own truth. When we speak instrumentally, we try to influence the listener by informing or affirming or rebuking or making common cause. But when we speak expressively, we speak to express the truth within us, honoring the inner teacher by letting it know that we are attending to its voice. Our purpose is not to teach anyone anything, but to give the inner teacher a chance to teach us. Of course, knowing when we are speaking from the soul rather than the intellect or ego is difficult, since the intellect and ego insist that they are the center of our lives and they speak the voice of truth. It takes time to learn to distinguish between the various voices within us, and even more time to get regular access to the voice of soul. The signs that we are speaking from that inward center are subtle as the stillness of a pond. The capacity to recognize them grows slowly as we speak in a space where no one is making ripples. Though it is hard to know when we are speaking from our own center, it is not so hard to know when we are speaking to the center of the circle. Expressive speaking is less stressful than its instrumental counterpart. When we speak directly to others in order to achieve a goal, we feel the anxiety that comes from trying to exercise influence. But when we speak to the center of the circle, free of the need to achieve a result, we feel energized and at peace. Now we speak with no other motive than to tell the truth, and the self-affirming feelings that accompany such speech reinforce the practice. How we listen in a circle of trust is as important as how we speak. When someone speaks from his or her center to the center of the circle, the rest of us may not respond the way we normally do, with affirmations or rebuttals or some other way of trying to influence the speaker. So we learn to take in whatever is said with as much simple receptivity as we can muster. Receptive listening is an inward and invisible act, but in a circle of trust, it has at least three outward and visible signs. Allowing brief, reflective silences to fall between speakers rather than rushing to respond. Silences that honor those who speak, give everyone time to absorb what has been said, and slow things down enough so that anyone who wishes to speak can do so. Responding to the speaker not with commentary but with honest, open questions that have no other intent than to help the speaker hear more deeply whatever he or she is saying, a demanding art that is the subject of the next chapter. Honoring whatever truth-telling has been done by speaking one's own truth openly into the center of the circle, placing it alongside prior expressions as simple personal testimony, with no intent of affirming or negating other speakers. When people speak instrumentally, trying to get leverage on each other, it is nearly impossible to listen receptively to what another says. We listen with half a mind at best, busily filtering what we hear so that we can embrace what we agree with and reject the rest. We listen, that is, with our egos. But when people speak expressively, we listen openly, with our souls. Now we can attend fully to whatever is being said, knowing that people are not trying to comment on us and our truth, but are making an honest effort to express truths of their own. As we grow in our ability to listen this way, we give the gift of hearing each other into speech. As our listening becomes more open, and speakers start to trust that they are being heard by people whose only desire is to make it safe for everyone to tell the truth, their speaking becomes more open as well. Like every gift given, this one returns as a gift to the giver. When we learn how to listen more deeply to others, we can listen more deeply to ourselves. This may be the most important result of the unconventional speaking and listening that go on in a circle of trust. When our discourse is aimed at influencing other people, we dare not listen too carefully to our own words, let alone be self-critical about them, lest we start to doubt their validity, become embarrassed by their implications, or otherwise lose the leverage we seek. But as we are liberated from adversarial speaking and listening, we are much more likely to hear and reflect on things we ourselves have said. Now we have the disarming experience of being taught by our own inner teacher. When I speak from my own center to the center of the circle, in the presence of listeners who neither affirm nor negate what I say, my words simply sit there in the space between us, in full view of everyone, including me. Now I am much more likely to have inner colloquies in which I am questioned or challenged or affirmed. They may come in the middle of a meeting, during a meal, or when I awaken at night. Why did I say that when I don't really believe it? I believe what I said, but I am really not sure what it means. I've known for a long time that what I said is true for me, but I had not understood how true it is until just now. As I look at the truth I spoke, I suddenly see implications for my life that I had never seen before. Many of us have been in settings where there are ground rules to govern speaking and listening. In therapy groups, for example, we are asked to give speakers feedback so that they can understand the emotional impact their words have on others. In appreciative inquiry groups, we are asked to paraphrase what we hear speakers say to find out whether we understand what they really mean. These rules can serve good ends in their native settings, but they will undermine the integrity of a circle of trust. Here, it does not matter how listeners are affected by what the speaker says, except when someone violates the circle's rules. Nor does it matter whether listeners understand what the speaker intended to say. In a circle of trust, the only feedback that counts is that which comes from within the speaker, and the only understanding that counts is the speaker's own. All that matters here is that we hold each other in a space where the soul feels safe enough to speak its truth, and we feel safe enough to become more receptive to the implications of that truth for our lives. What happens within us in a circle of trust takes us well beyond narcissistic self-absorption or the fruitless recycling of self-referencing thought. We have a conversation with our own souls, one that just might change our lives. Telling our stories. When the space between us is made safe for the soul by truthful speaking and receptive listening, we are able to speak truth in a particularly powerful form, a form that goes deeper than our opinions, ideas, and beliefs. I mean the truth that emerges as we tell the stories of our lives. As the writer Barry Lopez has noted, truth cannot be reduced to aphorisms or formulas. It is something alive and unpronounceable. Story creates an atmosphere in which truth becomes discernible as a pattern. Storytelling has always been at the heart of being human because it serves some of our most basic needs, passing along our traditions, confessing failings, healing wounds, engendering hope, strengthening our sense of community. But in our culture of invasion and evasion, this time-honored practice cannot be taken for granted. It must be supported in special settings and protected with strong ground rules. Because our stories make us vulnerable to being fixed, exploited, dismissed, or ignored, we have learned to tell them guardedly or not at all. Neighbors, co-workers, and even family members can live side by side for years without learning much about each other's lives. As a result, we lose something of great value. For the more we know about another's story, the harder it is to hate or harm that person. Instead of telling our vulnerable stories, we seek safety in abstractions, speaking to each other about our opinions, ideas, and beliefs, rather than about our lives. Academic culture blesses this practice by insisting that the more abstract our speech, the more likely we are to touch the universal truths that unite us. But what happens is exactly the reverse. As our discourse becomes more abstract, the less connected we feel. There is less sense of community among intellectuals than in the most primitive society of storytellers. I learned something about the connection between storytelling and community while sitting in a Quaker meeting for worship, a communal silence out of which people occasionally speak. I listened as one man grieved the recent death of his best friend, telling a moving story about an experience the two of them had shared. I did not know this man or his friend, but the story he told took me deep into my own life. It brought my own friends to mind and reminded me of how precious they are and of how important it is that I let them know of that fact. After 10 or 15 minutes of silence, another person spoke, describing with uncanny accuracy what had happened within me as I listened to the first person speak. "We believe that we will find shared truth by going up into big ideas," she said. "But it is only when we go down, drawing deep from the well of personal experience, that we tap into the living water that supplies all of our lives." I know of dialogue groups where this principle is given an acid test. People who are at each other's throats over thorny issues like abortion or the death penalty are brought together for a facilitated weekend retreat. During their time together, they are forbidden from announcing, explaining, or defending their position on the issue at hand. Instead, they are invited to tell personal stories about the experiences that brought them to whatever position they hold while others listen openly. This process often creates more mutual understanding than other modes of conflict resolution, especially as people are reminded that similar experiences can lead different individuals to very different conclusions. We find common bonds in the shared details of the human journey, not in the divergent conclusions we draw from those details. Stories are evoked in many ways in a circle of trust. Sometimes they emerge as people make spontaneous connections between the topic being discussed and events in their own lives. Sometimes the facilitator solicits stories of a particular sort. "Tell us about an experience in which you felt a deep sense of community." And sometimes the facilitator invites people to bring stories in the form of case studies, structured tales of particular life moments that allow us to take a close look at our travels on the Möbius Strip. Teachers, for example, are invited to bring case studies of a good moment and a bad moment in the classroom, a moment when they knew they were born to teach, and a moment when they wished they had never been born, to help them see more clearly how soul and role both come together and fall apart in the course of daily life. Our personal stories are also evoked by the third things we use to help focus a circle of trust. as we saw in chapter 6, a story such as The Woodcarver, or a poem such as Now I Become Myself, can help us learn from our experience in ways that go much deeper than simply talking about what happened. Archetypal big stories such as these shed light on the little stories of our lives, revealing meanings that we might otherwise miss. When we tell our personal stories in a circle of trust, the ground rules prohibit people from helping us solve whatever problem may be embedded in those stories. But storytelling in such a circle often yields powerful solutions nonetheless, in the lives of those who speak and of those who listen. As a speaker, especially if I talk about things I find shameful or painful, the solution may come from discovering that I can tell my story without being cast into the outer darkness. As I realize that people are receiving my self-revelation without judgment, I find myself freed to dig deeper into the root system of my issue, and the resulting self-knowledge may contain something of the solution I need. As a listener, I may discover that someone in the circle has a problem similar to mine, and as I hear it voiced in another person's words, I gain new insight into my own dilemma. Sometimes, as I hear the person explore a possible resolution to his or her problem, my own inner teacher is evoked. At the very least, knowing that someone else has a problem like mine gives me a sense of not being crazy and alone that in itself can open a path to deeper self-understanding. A story does not need to become a puzzle with a solution or a fable with a moral in order to do its problem-solving work in our lives. Telling a story expressively, as an end in itself, can contribute powerfully to our insight, healing, and enlivenment. The philosopher Martin Buber pointed to this power in a story about a story. A story must be told in such a way that it constitutes help in itself. My grandfather was lame. Once they asked him to tell a story about his teacher, and he related how his teacher used to hop and dance while he prayed. My grandfather rose as he spoke, and he was so swept away by his story that he began to hop and dance to show how the master had done. From that hour on, he was cured of his lameness. That's how to tell a story. What is truth? The soul wants truth, not trivia. So if the space between us is to welcome the soul, it must be a space in which truth can be told. Our ability to create and protect such a space depends on how well we understand the assumptions about truth and the way truth emerges among us that form the foundations of a circle of trust. These assumptions will not find favor with people who believe that there are absolute answers to the deepest questions of our lives, and that those who know the answers are obliged to convert everyone else. As the ground rules of a circle of trust make clear, especially the rule that forbids fixing, saving, advising, and setting straight, the arrogance of absolutism is not welcome here. But neither is the mindlessness of relativism. In fact, the very act of participating in a circle of trust and abiding by its disciplines takes us well beyond the silly and dangerous notion that there is one truth for you, another truth for me, and never mind the difference. If I believed that, I simply would not bother with this vexatious thing called community, where I must speak and listen in ways that might alter my understanding of what is true. You and I may hold different conceptions of truth, but we must mind the difference. Whether we know it or not, like it or not, acknowledge it or not, our lives are interconnected in a complex web of causation. My understanding of truth impinges on your life, and yours impinges on mine. So the differences between us matter to both of us. A circle of trust honors both our differences and our connections. My working definition of truth is simple, though practicing it is anything but. Truth is an eternal conversation about things that matter, conducted with passion and discipline. Truth cannot possibly be found in the conclusions of the conversation, because the conclusions keep changing. So if we want to live in the truth, It is not enough to live in the conclusions of the moment. We must find a way to live in the continuing conversation, with all its conflicts and complexities, while staying in close touch with our own inner teacher. In a circle of trust, we can dwell